The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
I'm going to tell myself that okay. If I go really long, just pull me off.
Okay.
Thank you, comrades. I think that we can say that the presence of a talk like this on a conference like ours is a real indication, particularly given the many really important questions we need to debate, that the geeks have truly arrived. We're here. We rule the world. Our culture is the dominant culture. We don't have to grovel at the feet of the culture industry anymore. They come to us and pander. This is truly a success. And I take it as a given that the single most important figure responsible for ushering in this brave, weird dawn in the distance, towering above everybody, is a superhero. It has become the cultural touchstone for geek culture more generally. And I think it's hopefully the case that everybody here will agree with me that it's extremely sweet to be spoon-fed a steady diet of movies, television programs, serialized picture books, and even amusement park rides featuring the Caped Crusaders we all know and love. Superheroes and superhero stories have become so ubiquitous that I would wager there are more people in the world who can name the secret identity of Batman than can name the Prime Minister of India. And that's to say that Modi is only the third or fourth most famous fascist in the world. Getting down to it, you might ask why there should be a talk about superheroes and what they mean at this conference, other than providing an excuse for people to wear their costumes, of which I see none, I just want to say at the outset. Very disappointed. I have worn mine, but you know, I have a secret identity to protect. If I wore my costume, then it would reveal it. The cultural power of superheroes might have recently reached cosmic levels, but they've been with us for quite some time. They're capitalism's, American capitalism's, most enduring trope. I'm going to assert that and hopefully make the case. That assertion does lead to some questions, and the current moment leads to some questions in general about why exactly it is that superheroes are so popular, why they've outlived several generations of their own creators, why, as of late, have they become so massively profitable. My hope is that by the end of the evening, everyone will walk away with some understanding of those questions and also will have absorbed the correct line on superheroes. Before moving on to that, I want to throw out a couple of indisputable truths that are going to be undergirding the entire analysis to follow. First, comics are the highest form of art. I'll fight you if you disagree. And two, any effort to make the case that comics should be taken seriously that begins, yes, but graphic novels are different, is inherently reactionary and we should reject it and move on. So, why are they so popular? There have been a number of very useful and quite serious attempts to better understand superheroes as a starting point for getting at this question, but most of them are also extremely fraught. The most famous, by far, is Charles Wortham's panic-stricken screed, The Seduction of the Innocent, which argued, among other things, that stories about a billionaire playboy and his young ward running around in their pajamas, thrusting their fists at things, couldn't be anything other than a gay fantasy designed to undermine the nuclear family. He's not completely wrong. His proposals for censorship, we probably would part company on that question. More recently, and a lot less hysterically, Kent Worcester, Charles Hatfield, and Jeet Heer, I think that's how you say all their names, edited a volume called The Superhero Reader that's pitched as an intervention arguing with the burgeoning field of comic studies that superheroes are also worthy of critical inquiry. Fair enough, nothing to disagree with here. Unfortunately, the majority of the pieces in the collection also seem to think that the genre is a little more than bread and circuses for the masses. Then there's comics legend Alan Moore, who most people will know, who periodically slinks down from whatever tree he happens to be living in and sneers at the slovenly masses for what he perceives as their acceptance of our culture's penchant for recycling juvenile fantasies over and over again. It's like, we get it, dude. You tried to kill superheroes several times. You failed. People haven't understood you. Being an artist is hard. But grow up. I'm going to try and part company with a bunch of these and draw more from what I think is far and away the best account that I've come across, because it's very good because it combines both a good balance of comics history and insider knowledge. Grant Morrison's Super Gods, which is upstairs, there's a couple of copies, pick it out. Folks who read some comics know Grant Morrison has been around for a little while. it is, like I say, the best one that's out there, but it too is weighed down by the same kind of New Age bullshit that makes his comics a little bit hard to read a lot of times. If people have read him, you'll maybe get some of the references. In between his musings about the 12-year solar cycle that explains everything about the world, for real, this is what he thinks, Morrison makes the case that superheroes are essentially gods for a secular society. And to borrow a phrase from Marx, not Morrison, they're a heart in the heartless world, the collective sigh of an oppressed society, the soul of soulless conditions. They're a light that we turn to in the darkest of nights. And there's a logic to this. I think that there's something to agree with there. They routinely face down impossible odds, they're always striving to do the right thing, and they look just like us with all of our flaws, foibles, and struggles to juggle our shitty jobs while also preventing Galactus from consuming our world to sate his unquenchable hunger. Just like us. These essential qualities are things that have been present in superheroes since Clark Kent first ducked into a phone booth a little over 80 years ago. At a moment when this country was suffering through the Great Depression, but also stood on the cusp of becoming the global hegemon. And the timing of their origin was not just an accident. The comics boom was the pulp, and by that I mean the less stuffy and thus better, equivalent of literary modernism in a lot of ways. The ravages of global capitalism, namely the First World War and the Great Depression, left millions desolate and desperate for a break from the soul-rending status quo. Superheroes offered exactly the right dose of fantasy-laden escapism to tap into these hopes. In his earliest stories, for example, the Man of Steel spent most of his time fighting off mobsters, bankers, landlords, the odd abusive husband, and other manifestations of social ills. Superman was more or less a socialist everyman who happened to possess a superhuman strength that allowed him to leap over tall buildings and do other things like have no shame and wear his underpants over his pants while in public. And it was less than a year after Superman first entered onto the scene when Batman appeared in Detective Comics, and it wasn't long before these two titans of the genre were joined by a dozen, and then more, other costume heroes with increasingly absurd outfits. I don't have time to go through an entire history to systematically build my case, which means you're just gonna have to take me at my word. But the other element of the genre's superhuman longevity and resilience has been its ability to adapt to a changing world and remain relevant at various periods. To quote Morrison, we can analyze them out of existence, kill them, ban them, mock them, and still they return, patiently reminding us who we are and what we wish we could be. Enter the smoke, and when the lights return, I can't guarantee that somebody's not trying to undermine me, but to a plot. We will stand against it, comrades. So they remind us what we wish we could be. This also happens to be a lot of what makes them so profitable as well. Superheroes are the commodification of some of our deepest escapist desires. Which brings us to what everyone's really been waiting for, the advertised political economy part of the talk. Two quick qualifications before getting into the number crunching. First, I'm no Amadeus Cho over here. Please be gentle with me, my math may be fuzzy. Second, it's worth bearing in mind that profit is whatever a CFO tells their board of, their board prior to presenting on the quarterly profits, meaning they make this shit up. The reason I qualify that is because, we'll get into that. On the printed side, 2017 saw record-breaking sales of comic books and trade releases with numbers topping $522 million. That figure amounts to roughly 90 million individual issues sold in comic books, bookstores, online, and all the rest of it. And loath as I am to admit it, for several years running, DC has been far and away the best performing company in terms of sales and the quality of their content. I agree. This is just a reality we have to deal with. However, and this is where we get our licks in, these numbers look like chump change in comparison to the money made with superheroes when superheroes take time out from their busy schedules to visit Hollywood and make a movie. Getting exact figures here becomes even more challenging because Tinseltown is filled with accountants who have the superhuman ability to bend reality to their own will. To give just one example, through utterly Byzantine methods understood only by studio executives, Sony claims that to this day it owes Stan Lee not a single penny for the first Spider-Man film, despite a clause in his contract, that he gets 10% of net profits. the film grossed north of $800 million and was made on a budget of something like $100 million. So that's a lot of overhead, even in Hollywood. But they said there's no profit, so they don't pay him a dime. Stan the Man's treatment should be seen as some heavy foreshadowing of my answer to the why. It's to come. But first, it seems like a good point in the talk to take a moment to say RIP to Steve Ditko, who people may have seen pass away last night. And I hope he's out there staying weird in the dark place someplace. Even with that said about the comics and the difficulty of figuring out how much money is made in the movies, by my math, the amount that's brought in is really staggering. To give a sense of the scale, in 2018, the entire film industry is expected to bring in about $44 billion by their own calculations. It's a huge amount of money. So far, which is by the middle of the end of June of this year, $4 billion of that has already come from supers, movies featuring supers. And there are four more films yet to come, Ant-Man, Dark Phoenix, Super Spider-Verse, and Aquaman. And I may have even missed them because it's a little hard to keep up at this point. So that's, you know, $44 billion total for all movies made anywhere. And $4 billion of that revenue is coming from superheroes. That's a lot. Digging down a little bit further, if we look only at the 23 movies featuring capes that are among the 100 highest grossing films in history, their combined efforts have brought in $22 billion in roughly 10 years. So there's a couple of things in that are worth thinking about. Like one, roughly 25% of the top grossing films of all time are superheroes. So I haven't even included in that total number ones that didn't make it into the top 100, and there are many that go down the list. And secondly, it's only in the past 10 years that this has become a phenomenon. So there's clearly something going on that's worth trying to grapple with. And it gets even more interesting when you look at the fact that $19 billion of that $22 billion is just in the past 6 years. So they figured it out, they got the formula, they're going for it, they're making a bunch of money. And for those keeping score at home with a partisan agenda like me, $12 billion of that $19 has gone exclusively to Marvel Studios. And then it becomes even higher if you count the number of movies that feature Marvel characters who are not included in Marvel Studios because of all sorts of other arcane deals and whatever that we can maybe talk about, but might just leave in the margins of the talk. So that's a bunch of the math, and the last bit of it that I'll go through is that if you deduct just production costs from the gross revenues that have been posted for superhero films, then you're at $17 billion in what a normal accountant would call profit. So in 6 years, $17 billion of profit, give them $6 billion of overhead and you're still in like stratospheric territory. And we haven't even begun to touch on the money made selling Spider-Man Speedos, Load to Hulk perfume, or maybe most regrettably Wonder Woman diet bars. Yes, they really did that. Thank you, capitalism. Whether you're out shopping for planters for the garden or a new pair of ultra-supportive insoles, you can rest easy knowing that there's no place in our society where one won't find the confident, ever-vigilant eye of a superhero watching over you. I'll skip that reference for time. There's enough Easter eggs, right? Hopefully that brief picture is enough to convince everyone that superheroes have skulked out of the shadowy margins of geekdom to claim their position as possibly the most profitable cultural commodity in the world. But why are they so profitable? There are a couple of component parts allowing for their meteoric rise in the past decade. For one thing, technology, I think, is a really key point. We've reached a moment when they can be convincingly rendered and not look embarrassing. You know, you only need to think about Adam West and his paunch clumsily climbing up the side of a building from the 1960s Batman to realize that we probably could use some special effects here. And the technical advance in the movie industry has allowed superheroes to tap into those fears and hopes that I mentioned that are generated by a capitalist, modern capitalist society, and we've reached a whole new level when the two things are together. Movies are just more profitable than comic books, no matter how you cut it, and that's going to be the case. They're making more movies, they're making more money. But I think that the real secret sauce stirred into this mixture is the hyper-exploitation of artists and writers, which has been baked into the comic book industry from the very start. Even though Walter Benjamin's Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction mostly talks about the film industry, I think many of its points are relevant for comics as well, even if the scale is slightly reduced, which is to say, the materiality of the production of comic books creates an inherently collaborative, creative process that allows for mass distribution, but also makes it much easier for the companies who front the capital at the outset to divide its participants and ramp up the rate of exploitation. Any given issue will have a team of writers, a team of artists, and a team of editors that divide the labor necessary to produce a finished product that often features characters and stories that have existed for decades. So that whole brew of things means that it's quite easy for an executive to say, well, it's not really clear that you contributed all that much at all. We'll just take the lion's share of it. And you know, it also gets more complicated when you start to think about what balance between individual artists the work actually falls to. Every creative relationship in the business looks somewhat different. Stan Lee was known to provide one-page summaries and leave details to Jack Kirby, whereas scripts written by Alan Moore for Dave Gibbons on Watchmen describe the size, the position, the flow of every single panel, plus every single item that appears in that panel in hyper-specific detail. Which is to say, Stan Lee wakes up in the morning, types out an outline, leaves it to the artist, Alan Moore writes a novel for every page, and the end result is still 32 pages of, you know, glossy color pictures at the end. But the main point, separate from like exactly what this creative relationship looks like, is that it's a group of creators who work together and produce two distinct commodities for their employers. One is men, women, mutants, and aliens that can do everything from project concussive rays from their eyes to regrow amputated arms, which is to say superheroes, and the physical sheets of paper that contain them. I think it's worth understanding these are two different commodities. We get into the theory and the deeper Marxist economics of that, but I think that that's essential for getting at how they're able to knit together these empires. To make that case even further, by their nature, comic books are made to rot and decay, but they generate a dizzying number of characters that don't even age and certainly can't be killed. And the companies producing them have always valued the subjects of their books much more than the creators who are producing them. Sounds pretty familiar, right? Anybody's familiar with that? And another reason that they happen to prefer the superheroes, and this is the rights of superheroes over the rights of humans, is because superheroes aren't very good at asking for a pay raise. This is the thing that it's not just a quip to say that. In the early days, DC, one of the two major companies, had the foresight and the stroke of genius to establish a policy whereby the company actually owns any character, plot, original art, or script that it publishes within its books. Which means that the most notorious example of this is a real cautionary tale that people going into the industry still talk about, which is Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, two bright-eyed kids from the Midwest who moved to the big city to try to sell their ideas, who were crushed by the weight of failed pitches and the dawning realization that they had probably to give up their dream if they didn't make it soon. They poured everything into their last-ditch effort, went to DC Comics with a story of an alien baby who crash lands on our planet and grows up to fight crime wearing a blue unitard and a red cape. The newly growing publisher was so taken by the tale that it offered Siegel and Shuster $130 for all of the rights to everything coming after that, produced by the character. Consequently, as far as the law is concerned, and as far as DC was concerned, when Superman went on to become a worldwide sensation, the pair were entitled to exactly $0 in royalties, and the company was able to spin off their character into as many different forms as they could imagine without even having to consult the two of them. They happened to keep them on retainer and paid them relatively well and all this, whatever, but no royalties entitled to them. Their estates weren't entitled to anything. There have been a number of lawsuits, trying to fight to get this control back, and it's been a flashpoint of organizing inside of the industry for quite some time. Lest we forget to kill our darlings, Stan Lee and Marvel Comics replicated this model when they crashed onto the scene in the 1960s, and this is the status quo with publishers owning all the rights to the characters created under their aegis to the present day. Image Comics, which was established in the 1990s, is slightly different. Some of comics' biggest superstars, including an artist who couldn't draw feet but yet was one of the most famous artists at the time, bucked this model. But even there, things aren't without contradictions. If you go to Image's website, it has submission guidelines and tells you what's necessary to be published by them. They say you can control all of your characters, you get everything that you produce, all the money that's generated is yours. But it takes a little while to pay you, and you have to have it all assembled. We're going to give you basically no support, etc. So basically, come in with a finished product, we'll slap our name on it and put it out. So to say that there's no you know, paradise for folks who are producing these things at all. So that one's not without contradictions either. In essence, what Marvel and to a lesser extent DC have created with their predatory contract structures and low production costs is a giant creative sandbox where they can try out thousands of stories a year to see which one becomes popular. Then, once they know they've got a hit, they give the green light, pour hundreds of millions of dollars into it, and produce an adaptation which can bring in maybe $1 billion if they're lucky. If they're not lucky, then probably somewhere in the range of, you know, $500 million to $700 million for a shit show like Suicide Squad. For real, it made a huge amount of money. They're gonna do another one. It's unwatchable. You're telling me. Incidentally, this material reality is why both of the big two, DC and Marvel, have also let their writers almost completely off the creative leash. In their rendering of things, it's basically like research and development always requires more failures than successes, so why not just let them go and do whatever? But they've maintained a really rigid conservatism when it comes to taking risks at the box office. So one of the like I think most useful examples in this is like Marvel's Civil War storyline, in which in the comics Captain America is assassinated on the steps of a courthouse after leading a rebellion against the Superhero Registration Act, versus in the movie where Captain America leads a rebellion maybe for friendship. It's really unclear. It doesn't make any sense. There's no politics. It's completely drained. Still makes a bunch of money. So this is the kind of thing that they're interested in doing. And there's a whole bunch of examples that you can go through, and I think it's genuinely the case in comics. You're getting some of the most experimental stuff happening in superheroes that you've seen in for as long as I've been reading them, and it's really great. If those stories get made into movies, the creators probably will see not one dime, and the studios will keep making a whole bunch of money. So this is the dilemma of the, you know, the fan. So that's the numbers. What about the politics? In some ways, this is the easy part, because let's be clear, a superhero at base is a mass vigilante who has vowed to take justice into their own hands, a reactionary, or at the very least, deeply elitist notion that we should reject and suggest is not the way we change the world. That's true. Thank you. Glad somebody like agrees with me here. Jeez, it's a rough crowd. But recognizing that essential truth, there's still quite a lot of latitude for social commentary, political critique, and metaphorical content within the genre. And different characters represent an astonishing range of political ideologies. As everyone should know by now, Batman's a fascist. I'm really sorry, comrades, there's nothing for it. So the fact that he's a billionaire who uses extreme violence to put low life into body casts should be the first indication. But there's also that deep, raspy voice. Like, the further you go into it, the more clear it is that this is just, you know, what he's about. Captain America, on the other hand, is your basic lanyard liberal. The man really, truly believes that America could be great. Sorry, truly believes that America is great, and always has been. And thinks that the way that we'll change the world is through some wholesome civil dialogue. The Fantastic Four are all family value conservatives. Tom King's The Visions, on the other hand, are basically the Shumaway Firestone of superhero comics. I know I run the risk of soliciting some hissing on this one, and I'm really sorry to break it to everyone, but Wonder Woman is definitely a TERF. I'm telling you, the gender essentialism runs very deep. Just read about Morrison and created it. Fight me. You've got Man-Thing and Swamp-Thing, who are both anarcho-primitivists, on top of being easily confused for one another. Catwoman, who's an obvious power feminist, and Green Lantern, who probably thinks the world is controlled by lizard people who live in the center of the earth. There's no textual evidence for that. I just figured that if you're the sort of person who has a power ring that can do literally anything, and all you can imagine is to create a giant green fist and fight your enemies with it, you're easily deceived. Colossus is a tanky. Aquaman is a posadist. The man talks to dolphins. Hawkeye, Kate Bishop, not Clint Barton, is a radical misandrist. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that Beta Ray Bill would have been a supporter of the Fourth International. And saving the most controversial for last, Black Panther is a benevolent monarchist who every socialist worth their salt should support deposing under the banner neither T'Challa nor Killmonger, but international socialism. Oh. And Wolverine is definitely an incel. I could go on. Even though I think these are 100% correct and uncontroversial classifications, they are, to be honest, a bit beside the point. Socialists can contribute a lot more to the discussion than just deciding which of these characters fits into which political ideologies. Fun as that is, and useful sometimes as it is, there's a burgeoning political consciousness among geeks that has accelerated along with the radicalization in our society more generally. And in some ways, it's even more condensed because of the presence within our tribe of the worst kind of elements, like the gamer gators and rabid puppies and various others who don't think that women are people. So more and more folks have been drawn to discussing the politics and the needs for most the need for a lot more left-wing ideas within comics and the movies, in stories about superheroes than almost any other like cultural commodity that you can think about. Untold numbers of internet servers crashed trying to keep up with the number of Black Panther hot takes posted after the movie's release, for example. Usually, within the geek circles and like online communities or whatever, the discussion is focused primarily on questions of diversity and representation. And I think it's important to say that socialists should suggest that this focus is necessary but insufficient for the sort of politics we want to bring to the stage around some of this stuff. And that's not just because I think it's already led to some egregious pandering that makes for terrible stories. It has. Kirby wept. Squirrel Girl beating Galactus in a fist fight should never happen. It's not something that can be tolerated, and it's completely beyond the pale. It's just true. As in many areas, I think we have to be ever cognizant of structural and not just representational questions. Marvel's comics have become some of the most woke around. Black Panther's being written by Ta-Nehisi Coates. Ms. Marvel is now a young Pakistani immigrant being written by an Arab American woman. But this hasn't translated into the movies, and it certainly hasn't translated into changes inside of the industry. Comic book creators still overwhelmingly look like me. And it's not just the white guy part. Most of them are bald. And it's kind of strange, you know, from Brian Michael Bendis to Brian K. Vaughan to Grant Morrison to Jason Aaron, and I can go on with the list. They're all bald and white. It's like, can't we even get just a little bit better? Like, maybe some with hair. I think, yeah, exactly. It's not a good look. If you can't have the hair, have the hair. I think that one of the things that we should contribute as geeks who happen to be radicals is that when we go to the cons, when we participate in these sorts of spaces, we should go carrying slogans supporting structural changes in the industry, including questions of creative control, which is part of the reason that I started with some of that stuff. As Marxists, we should also keep a few theoretical points in mind. If, and let's be honest, when we wade into debates about the political content of particular superhero movies or books. This is usually the part of the culture talks at this conference where you'll find a quote from Literature and Revolution, but turns out Trotsky doesn't have anything to say about Batman. So instead of going to where Trotsky, I actually think that Raymond Williams' framework of cultural materialism is much more helpful for thinking about some of this stuff, and the too long didn't read version of which is basically that any rigorous socialist analysis of a piece of culture needs to start with an understanding of the material and aesthetic logic of the particular medium. In other words, a video game is not a symphony performance, for obvious reasons, and we can't treat them the same. When it comes to comics and movies featuring the spandex-clad set, I've tried to do some of that above, right, in terms of the relationship between the creators, in terms of the relationship between the movies and the comic books. And I think that it's absolutely the case when you start to look into that, that their continued success and development grows from that symbiotic and but parasitic relationship. And this also then goes to the relationship between action figures and all the other merchandise, the video games, the Walmart exclusive t-shirt patterns, designer cosplay costumes, all that's part of a general nexus that I don't think you can just say like there's one thing to say about it. It's worth thinking about on its own terms. Some cosplay costumes are better than others, and we should support them on that basis. Not exactly what I'm saying, but it's a good line. The other thing that I think is really, really important is that as socialists, we should always and everywhere remain aware of the fact that these characters are commodities that we consume. And we should be wary of an over-identification with them that binds us to their limits and contradictions. geeks, and I include myself here, are so guilty of this. If you try to suggest that Magneto is not the sort of icon that we should hold up for our liberatory struggles, I'm gonna lose my shit, and we're gonna have to go outside and resolve our differences. Obviously, they're more than just commodities, and they do produce a kind of like identification that you can never get out of a Coke can or whatever else. And I think it's because of what I started with about why they appeal, why they're popular, and whatever. But it is still the case that that has to be our starting point. You know, they can't actually change the world. They're not the ones who are going to make the struggles that are necessary. They have a limit. And I think at this point about this fantastic piece by Sam Chris about J.K. Rowling in the midst of the Brexit debate. I don't know if people saw this, but J.K. Rowling in the midst of the debates about Brexit got on Twitter to make her contribution, which was, Dumbledore would be for Remain. And she was insisted on it. He would absolutely be with the immigrants and against the people who say otherwise. And Sam Chris's line, which I think we should keep in mind and think about as a framework, was, Dumbledore is a character you created. He's not real. Doesn't exist in the world. Doesn't matter what you think he thinks about it. I think that's super important, but it gets more complicated because these things are obviously mediated and places of contestation too. I agree with Sam that J.K. Rowling doesn't just get to dictate through authorial intent what it is that Dumbledore would think. I think our response would be like, actually, I think he thinks this. Just because you created him doesn't mean he's yours. That's a real thing. I mean, especially when you get into the context of characters who, like I say, have existed for 80 plus years. Is it correct to hold, you know, Batman up as a fascist, as the real true nature of the character, or to try and revise him and make him into, you know, cushier liberal who wants to have dialogues? I think we should actually end that question before keeping him as the fascist. That's what he is. Not just because it's, you know, the true character, but like, that's ultimately what the politics represent and what we can draw from it. More seriously, I think that this becomes complicated around some questions like, you know, the reception of the Black Panther movie, which people who, you know, the jokes make clear where I end up standing on this, but it's not for nothing that it's actually inspired huge numbers of people and that it does raise horizons and starts to create situations where people ask questions they would not have otherwise, even if we have to be clear, again, starting from a position of rigor, that the comrades who think that Killmonger would somehow be the, you know, the framework of liberation for the Black struggle, they're wrong. That's not there. We should have a debate about those things. Is that just to say, oh, it's complicated and maybe we should take it piece by piece? Maybe a little bit, and if that's a bit of a cop-out, then I'm sorry about that. But I do think that the most forceful argument that I would make is about that structural reality and keeping in mind those points. The characters can change in all sorts of ways and have continued to change, and people who care about them should advocate for them changing in better ways, as long as the stories are good. But the structural stuff, I think, actually could potentially be a flashpoint, and I think it's important for raising people's horizons who are in the culture. We should care what the pay rates are. We should care like whether there's any creative control. We should care about those things, not just whether the version of Superman that's being portrayed presently is the one that we think is the best. Have an opinion about that for sure, but anyway, starting to wrap up, I'll make one last general point as a takeaway. Superheroes and what we think about them are not the most important paving stone on the revolutionary socialist road to power, but it's not for nothing. We can have like actual debates about these things, and I think there are a number of different political markers that we can put down in the midst of this. But I hope that people can actually contribute to continuing to develop that. So, to be continued.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.